under 16, the Olympic qualifying age. Yesterday, a reporter asked Sacramone if she thought the girls looked 16.
No, I don't know. They look pretty young, but then again, I don't look 20, so I'm not one to judge.
Chinese officials provided passports saying the three girls are 16. The International Gymnastics Federation has accepted that. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Beijing.
Chinese authorities say there's some evidence Islamist fighters in western China may be responsible for several attacks in the province of Xinjiang. Several attacks over the past 9 days have left 31 people dead, including several attackers. There are rebels in the region who want to break off from China and create a separate homeland. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates. Experienced full-time professional agents listing and selling homes in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two, Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. I'm sorry to say that we were not able to hook up with our scheduled guest for this hour, business journalist Matthew Padilla. We'll talk with him about a book that he co-authored, looking at the roots of the mortgage and credit crisis. The title of the book is Chain of Blame. Every once in a while it happens. We can't find the guest as scheduled, so we'll see if we can get that set up for another day. Instead, we'll go to the archives of Focus 580 for a program we broadcast last July. This is a conversation with Drew Weston, author of the book The Political Brain. So as you listen to this hour of Focus, do keep in mind that we'll not be taking your calls. We like to think that when people go into the voting booth, that they are making a rational choice when they're deciding who they want to vote for, that they have spent time thinking about the issues that are important to them, where they are, and then looking at the candidates, sizing them up, looking at their positions, and then making a choice based on which of the candidates' policies would best suit them. That is what we like to think happens. But our guest for this part of Focus 580 says that's not what happens at all. Drew Weston is our guest. He's a clinical personality and political psychologist. He's professor in the departments of psychology and psychiatry in behavioral sciences at Emory University. He's also the founder of Weston Strategies. It's a political and corporate consulting firm. And he is the author of a newly published book that we'll be talking about here this morning. The title of his book is The Political Brain, and the subtitle says it all. It's The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Public Affairs is the publisher. In the book, he makes the argument that in politics, when reason and emotion collide, emotion invariably wins. He says that there is good reason to believe that there are three things that determine how people vote. They are their feelings toward the parties, their feelings toward the candidates, and then if that by that point they have made up their mind, their feelings toward the candidates' positions. It all is about emotion. Professor Weston, hello.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, and thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, great introduction.
Well, this is really it's distressing in a way, I think, because we continue to like to believe in everything that they do, I suppose. Well, almost everything. This particularly, we like to believe that human beings are rational,
right,
and that they make their choices in a rational kind of calculating way. And you have, I think, have established, and other people looking at this have established, no, that's not true. And at the same time, we can't quite seem to let go of the idea of what we would like it to be like.
Absolutely true. Yeah, it was a hard book to write that way because I'm an academic. I've committed my life to doing science, but sometimes you have to let the data draw you where they draw you.
Mm-hmm. Just maybe we could talk here a little bit about this 2004 study that you talk about right at the beginning and is mentioned in everything I read about the book. When you were trying to look at two groups of people that were – one group were people who were just solid, dyed-in-the-wool Republicans, and the other was solid, dyed-in-the-wool Democrats. And what you did was – this was at the time when the candidates were Mr. Bush and Mr. Kerry. And you sat them down and you showed them statements from the candidates. First, you would show the candidate saying one thing. And then you would show them another statement from the candidate that seemed completely to contradict the first. And you looked at what was going – you actually looked at what was going on in these people's brains. And you found out, understandably enough, is that say if this was a Republican and he was looking at contradictory statements of Mr. Kerry, you would expect a certain kind of – you would expect that person to acknowledge the fact that Kerry was contradicting himself. The interesting thing is that – if you took a look at what happened in that person's brain when they were looking at Mr. Bush, and the same thing with the Democrats, something completely different was going on. They saw the contradictions in the other guy, but they somehow did not want to acknowledge them in their own candidate.
Right. And what was, you know, what we were really trying to do is to track how exactly that happens in our brains. You know, what in the world are our brains doing as we're making whatever kind of calculation that is. And basically what we found were was that there were three things happening in the brain. One was that emotion circuits, particularly distress or negative emotion circuits, were extremely active. So these were partisans who were in distress, reading about their own candidate, something that was really contradictory, that made him look like he wasn't telling the truth or that he was pandering. The second set of circuits we saw active were some circuits right in the middle of the front of the forehead that are involved in regulating emotion, in trying to get us out of feeling something bad. So these were the circuits that were basically saying, how do I get out of this? This does not feel good. And then the third set of circuits that were most active were a set that are involved in monitoring and dealing with conflict. What do you do when you recognize a conflict when it doesn't feel good? How do you get out of it? And what was strikingly not active were the parts of the brain that, in over 100 studies of brain scanning studies done by neuroscientists studying reasoning, those reasoning circuits were essentially the dead zone.
Well, this there are a couple of implications you can draw from this, as you mentioned in the book. I suppose one of those would be if you're designing and running a campaign, don't waste time trying to convert the other guy's base because you can't.
That's exactly right. And it is one of the mistakes that the Republicans have never made and Democrats consistently make, which is that you should stop worrying about offending people on the other side who are the real diehards. Because nothing you say can possibly convince them that, you know, the political brain is essentially it's a closed shop. You know, mm-hmm. it's not open to a lot of information if you're a strong partisan. And so, you know, I routinely advise Democrats, ignore the first 30% of the polls that are not in your direction, because they tell you nothing of any particular interest other than that 30% of people are diehard conservatives, and there's nothing that you can say that will influence them.
Yeah. So again, sort of as we've said, one of the things that you draw from looking at a study like this is indeed, as we have said, as you write it in these words, that the political brain is an emotional brain. It's not a dispassionate calculating machine, and that also, and you know, in the interest of full disclosure, you do have a point of view, a political point of view. You've done consulting for Democrats, and I think your criticism, as you've just said, of Democrats is that the Republicans have been much better at making their pitch to potential voters on the emotional level, and that the Democrats just don't seem to want to accept that that's a reality that they have to deal with, and they still try to appeal to voters as if their brains were dispassionate calculating machines, which they're not.
Right. Well, you know, I hate to paraphrase or take a leaf from the book of Donald Rumsfeld, but I sometimes say that you have to work with the brain you have, not the brain you wish you had. but there is a flip side to this that is that for people who are thinking, oh my God, you know it. We're here's a guy who's suggesting that Democrats just use strategies of irrationality and emotional persuasion and manipulation, is that what the Republicans have done at times that I object to and talk about in the book, because the book in some ways is very admiring to Republicans about the way they've understood that, you know, we're all values voters. Every one of us votes on the basis of some combination of our interests, what's good for us and our family, and our values, what we think is morally right. And Republicans understand that people vote on the basis of their moral ideals. Democrats tend to hide that stuff in the fine print of their policies, and they give such a high noise to signal ratio about what it is that they actually care about, when in fact what voters are doing most of the time is they're sizing up what you care about, and secondarily whether or not they can trust you. Those are the major decisions that they're making, and that's really not a terribly irrational thing to do, given that when you look at, say, a question like poverty, is there anything rational to helping out people who are poor when you're not? Well, no, there's actually not, unless you want to come up with some good rationalizations about, you know, the dangers of having an underclass in a democracy or something. But that's about your gut level moral emotions about does it bother you? Does it make you feel there's something morally wrong here when generations of kids don't have the chance that your kids have, and you either feel that or you don't.
Well, I think you also make the argument that it's you would not be saying to any candidate that you should completely eliminate any appeal to reason as you're trying to talk to people about what it is you believe and why they should vote for you, but that human beings are naturally inclined to telling stories. They like stories, so you can't hit them with facts up front. At the very least, your thin edge of the wedge is a story, and once you've got them, then maybe you could sneak in a couple of facts, but that's really not don't hit them with statistics in your first sentence. If you got to do that, make it simple and save it for later.
That's absolutely right. If you think about the structure of a logical argument, you know, it's you lay out your points logically, and that's how Democrats have tended to address the electorate. So when Michael Dukakis was asked that question in 1988 by Bernard Shaw about what would you, if your wife Kitty were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty? What people were expecting was an emotional reaction that any normal man would have. And they were expecting some kind of moral position on the death penalty. And he could actually have done that. He could have said, you know what, if someone raped and murdered my wife, I would hope that I wasn't in a room with him, because I'd want to do what every man out there would want to do, which is to strangle him with my bare hands. But there's a reason that I don't do that, and it's because, and you know, I don't know what his because was, because he never told the American people, but my guess was it was something along the lines of that if to put to death 500 murderers and serial rapists, we end up killing 5 innocent men. That's not a trade-off I'm willing morally to make. And if he were a religious man, he could have added to that, you know, I'll leave questions about who lives and dies to God. But here on earth, what I want to do is I want to put people who commit heinous crimes behind bars for the rest of their lives, and I'm happier to let 500 scumbags rot in a prison than to kill 5 innocent men. And if you don't agree with me on that, then go, please vote for my opponent. If it feels to you that knowing that there are 35 people who this year are up on death row who might be executed, and that I'm not going to execute them because of my moral values, then you should vote for my opponent. But if you see me as taking a principled position on this, it may not be yours. You just need to know that it's a principled position. The answer he gave instead, of course, was no, Bernie. You know, as you know, I've been an opponent of the death penalty all my life. I've seen no evidence that it's a deterrent, and there are better, more effective ways to solve violent crime. that was answering in the language of logic as opposed to in the language of values, and mm-hmm. that, I think, was his mistake.
That's, you know, as the way you sketch it out as being the response he might have given, it seems to me that it's a beautiful response, and that would kind of be my inclination, too, to say right up front, well, Bernie, what I'd like to do is kill the guy myself. But I guess I also find myself wondering, and I know that if that would have happened, that jaws would have dropped across the country. I'm sure that people initially could not believe that anybody would say that, would be that honest and that straightforward, and would say that. And I guess I just find myself wondering, could any candidate do that, and that would the emotional response that viewers and listeners have to that, would that sort of short circuit any? Would they hear anything the candidate said after that?
Well, given that this country is mostly pro-death penalty, and that most of it does come from that angry, vengeful feeling of, you know, I mean, I have the same feeling myself. I have two little girls, and if anyone ever touched them, I'd want to kill a person with my bare hands. And that's a normal human response. And, you know, one of the main messages of my book is that one of the reasons the Democrats keep losing elections is because they're not honest with people about their responses. You know, that on virtually every wedge issue, whether it has to do with race, whether it has to do with whether it's gays, whether it's immigration, whether it is abortion, whether it's guns, Republicans will offer a clear principle. They'll say, I believe life begins at conception, no ifs, ands, or buts. And the Democrat will say, unless they happen to live in on one of the two coasts or in maybe Champaign-Urbana or Ann Arbor or you know, a couple of Midwestern cities like Chicago, they'll say something like, well, I'm mostly for a woman's right to choose, but I voted for the partial birth abortion ban and I support parental notification. And as a voter, you listen to that and you think, well, do you have principles, or was that just because that's what the polls told you? And ironically, what I think hurts Democrats more than anything else is that they do not appear honest, because they're not, in fact, being honest with people about what their real values are. They're not spelling out principles the way Republicans are. And I think a lot of them are worried that they can't present principles in a soundbite. But it's you can't do a more complex principle in one sentence. But actually, on most of these issues, you can do it in about three.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Drew Weston. He's a political psychologist. He's professor in the departments of psychology, psychiatry, and behavioral sciences at Emory University. And if you would like to read more on this subject, you can look for his new book. It's titled The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. It's published by Public Affairs. And we have several callers here. We'll get started here, bringing some people into the conversation. And again, I just ask people to try to be brief, and that way we can get in as many callers as possible. First up here is someone listening in Kankakee on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Does the guest find any redeeming qualities in the affective domain playing the part he has found that it plays in decision-making? And if so, what might they be? Thank you.
I'm not sure I quite understood the question.
I think the caller was asking was, is there the fact that in their decision-making as far as choosing the candidate, the fact that people are more emotional rather than rational, is there any – what can you say about that, and is there anything that's good about that? Is there anything that's positive about that? I think we seem almost – and maybe, again, it's because we don't like to let go of the idea that people are not really being rational. What's the positive side of the fact that in their responses, people generally are more emotional than they are rational?
I actually think it's mostly a good thing, to tell you the truth. Just to give you an example, I don't remember Martin Luther King's I Have a Plan speech, but I do remember his I Have a Dream speech. And that speech was not aimed at convincing us rationally that black people and white people should have the same rights. What he was simply saying to us all was, I have a dream that one day my children will be judged on the content of their character, not on the color of their skin, and I want you to have that dream with me. Well, you know, our most barbaric acts and our most exalted acts as human beings come from our emotions. And so you can use emotion for good or ill, but the reality is that we don't pick our spouses on the basis of a rational appraisal of their costs and benefits. We don't make many decisions on that basis, and we sure don't pick our elected leaders that way.
Hmm. Well, I suppose you can make the argument that human beings are not Vulcans, you know, that this
exactly.
is just, this is what we are. So you have to, in a sense, accept that, acknowledge it, work with it, because that's not something that's, we've been like that for a long time. We, as you point out in the book, human beings had feelings before they had intellect and reason, and it's not something that's likely to change anytime soon.
That's right. And most of the time, our emotions are actually a pretty good guide for us. A good example of this was actually at the beginning of the 2000 election, and here I will sound like a partisan, but at the beginning of the 2000 election, George Bush had that notorious smirk on his face. And his handlers, because they were Republicans, knew right away that that was the first thing to address, because people were picking up that it had a meaning that they didn't like. Now, they didn't necessarily know what that meaning was. This is the kind of thing that Malcolm Gladwell describes in Blink. They just knew there was something about that that made them uncomfortable and that they didn't like it. And if you think about what has been the Achilles heel of the Bush administration, it has been the nearly pathological certainty that President Bush has about his attitudes, even when they're not grounded in any data whatsoever. And there's a kind of a smugness and a condescension towards people who believe differently that was expressed, I think, frankly, when the voters said in 2006, we want our troops home, and he basically gave them the finger and said, you know what, I'm going to increase the number of our troops. That was all encapsulated in that smirk, and had people paid attention to that smirk, they actually probably would have voted differently.
Hmm. Well, I think you would make the argument that this understanding, this dynamic, this emotion, intellect thing, and how it is that people respond, and how it is that, why it is that they vote the way they do, will go some way to explain the success of the Republicans and Mr. Bush in 2000-2004. Does that also explain what happened in 2006? And I suppose one of the questions that people continue to raise about 2006 is that in what respect was this a referendum on the president and was a vote against his policies? And to what extent was this people embracing the Democratic Party and the idea that they somehow thought the Democrats had a different and better way to go?
It's a great question, and it's easy to forget some history, which is even recent history, which was that in early 2006, Democratic strategists were telling their candidates, don't talk about the war, basically try to move on, don't put it on the table, because people were mixed about the war. And it wasn't until I actually think if you follow the data, it wasn't until August when you actually saw a clear shift where Americans started to split from kind of 50-50 for and against the war to being overwhelmingly against it. And what changed was not their calculations about 2,526 soldiers had died versus now 2,612 had died. That was not what changed for them. It was that their feelings about the war had changed. It had gone from patriotic fervor to a sense of hopelessness and anger, and a sense that we were losing young men and women, and not so young men and women had been called back from the reserves for a cause that we were led into by either faulty intelligence or cherry-picked intelligence, and that the administration wasn't leveling with us about it. So what really changed were people's feelings at that point, and once their feelings changed, their votes changed along with it. But the dangers that we got from the Democratic strategists in 2006 telling Democrats, regardless of what you actually believe about the war, don't talk about it or basically express your support for the troops. That's the kind of advice that I describe in this book as completely misguided, both morally and politically. You never want to separate a candidate from his or her values, because voters pick it up, and because what's the point of governing if you're not going to govern based on what you actually believe?
Let's talk with some other callers. Back here locally, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, the actually, the last point was kind of interesting. I was going to mention something about the Democrats, particularly the presidential level candidates, coming off like they're dishonest, and Republicans coming off like they're honest. And yet, you know, if you look at these shifts for Cheney, I think McCain had one, Giuliani, the shifts in how they feel about women's right of choice as they run for president. Bush, when he was running, how do you feel? He was confronted with the question, how do you feel about the number of prisoners executed in your state? And he said, well, I believe Texas lawmen don't make mistakes. This was in 2000. And, you know, it seems to me there's a lot of dishonesty there, even though it sounds like it could be an honest response, whereas the Democrats, you just put your finger on it, are apparently being counseled to stand for nothing. Just this year, after, you know, years of watching how badly it fails, you see both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton being confronted with the question about gays in the military, and they both do a huge no comment, and then have a spokesman later come out and, you know, backpedal. And it just makes me wonder about, you know, you're not quite saying it accurately when you say one response is honest and one isn't. I think you're getting a lot of dishonest responses either way, but one that is designed to be, I don't know, less dishonest by standing for nothing, and another that's just, well, let's just lie, it looks like to me, anyway. And the other point is, how do these strategists stay in the positions they have if they're failing so consistently and have for so long? That's all.
Mm-hmm. I think you raise great questions, and I'll try to remember both of them. I actually do agree with you with that the Republicans now, both the ones who are running, but certainly what we've seen out of the Bush administration is, I think in many ways this next election is going to be a referendum it's going to be an election that's about honesty and about who is not going to lie to me, in the same way that 1976 was an election where Jimmy Carter basically said to people after Richard Nixon, I'm going to tell you the truth as president. And I think that's what people really want, because they feel like they've been lied to. And you know, if you look at what happened to John McCain's campaign, people say, you know, some people say, well, it's because of his stance on the Iraq War. Some people say it's because of his stance on immigration. I think it comes back to the way our brains look for stories, and that, you know, before for thousands of years before we developed literacy as a species, what we used to transmit knowledge across generations and transmit values were stories. And the story that John McCain was telling about himself that was so compelling to people actually across the aisle, I liked the man in 2000, was that he was a straight-talking guy who rode the Straight Talk Express. And that was the story that he told, and was the story that had he not been under the sway of bad advisors, and had he not been so desperate to get elected that he was willing to, you know, to kiss the brass ring of Jerry Falwell and to talk to with people who he had called agents of intolerance and show up at their universities and talk highly about them and switch his positions. Doing those things was a tremendous mistake, not just because, for the same reason I'm describing, that I think it's a mistake when Democrats don't believe in a war but vote for it. Or don't talk about abortion because they're afraid that their position isn't going to match their constituents. What he was essentially doing was to undercut the whole story that was the story of John McCain and why you would vote for him. And so, you know, again, I think that was a terrible mistake. And I think the Republican nominees this time are very vulnerable to this flip-flopping charge, because it's true about them. And Mitt Romney was essentially a Massachusetts liberal who's flip-flopped. I think that would be a great set of ads to run against him in 2008 if he finds his way into the general election.
I think also that the caller was asking essentially a question, how is it the political consultants continue to find employment if even after they go through an election period where they've just fallen completely flat on their faces?
This is where, once again, I think Republicans have it right and Democrats have it wrong, and that is that Republicans use market mechanisms to determine who they're going to have as their consultants. If someone gets a bad win-lose record after a while, they say, you know what, we're not going to hire you. And Democrats, if someone gets a bad win-lose record after a long period of time, Bob Schrum is the prototypical example of this, who's 0-8 in presidential contests, and there was the Shrum primaries in 2000 and 2004 for, you know, who would he decide to back, and everyone was desperately hoping he would back them and work on their campaign. Democrats look at it and they say, wow, look at this guy's resume. You know, he's worked for all of these people. And that itself is a huge problem, as is the other piece of this is there's a way that Democratic consultants are risk averse that Republican consultants are not, that they know that they're not going to lose their jobs if they caution, because if you caution, you don't caution anyone to say anything that could then come back and backfire. And the problem with caution is that if you essentially make your candidates look pollster-driven and cowardly. And sometimes you have to stick your neck out, because leading is really about being sometimes a step or two ahead of where the public is, and not always a step or two behind, watching to see where the public wants you to be.
Hmm. We have another caller here. This is line number two, Charleston. Hello.
Yes. Opening the subject of emotion and intellect again, I'll try to keep this short. We recently, for your guest's information, had two young black men from Chicago came downstate, invaded a family, killed a police officer, took a hostage in a tiny little town up here, and the authorities were there in great numbers, and the kid finally surrendered. And both of them are in jail, million-dollar bonds and all that. The thing that I want to say about emotion intellect, that you respond to your environment. The Democrats, Republicans respond to the environment that they appeal to. And all the nuance and the filth that goes with that is apparent to everybody, or should be, because of the heinous condition of the world today. I'm wondering who terrorists are. The terrorists are the capitalist manipulators who go about robbing everybody. And the thing that I want to end with is these fellows, young kids, I think 23 and 26, something like that, young men, and if some person who advocates a death penalty went and lived in Chicago ghettos for a week using the emotion, intellectual survival mechanism, that's how you turn out, and it is all predictable. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if that you can make some response to that.
Well, I'll comment this time from the point of view of someone who's been a clinical psychologist for 25 years and seen patients for a number of years. And I know what the caller is talking about from having, for example, interviewed sex offenders. You know, when I see them on television, I have the normal human reaction and the normal father's reaction, which is, you know, the kind version of it, and for the airwaves version of it is, it put them away for life. But when you actually interview these guys, what you hear is there's a percent of them who are simply psychopaths who were probably born that way. There's some good evidence to suggest that, and we're busy tracking down the genetics of this now. My research group is working on some of this, but many other people have done some great work on the genetics of it, and it's clear that there's a kind of person who is born without the normal connections between emotion and regulation of their behavior just simply without the ability to feel for another person that renders them likely to become a psychopath and a violent criminal and to commit all kinds of offenses. But, you know, you talk to some of these guys and they were abused by their own fathers or uncles or stepfathers or grandfathers, and they didn't ask to have their sexuality disturbed and distorted by the experiences as they had as a kid, but it was. And, you know, I look at some of them and I just think, you know, if I'd been talking to this guy 30 years earlier when he had just been molested, I would be feeling such compassion for him. And now, you know, you look at him you look at him as an adult and you look at it from the outside and you see what he's done, and it's very hard to feel the compassion. And this is again where I wouldn't recommend Democrats run on a compassion for sex offenders plan, but I would recommend that they talk more openly about things like what are the conditions like in the inner cities that conservatives talk about, that they talk about as, you know, look how morally irresponsible these parents are being when the mom is having kids at 16, the dad isn't even around, they're using crack cocaine, they're neglecting their kids. The kid often goes from one family to another or one family member to another. You know, I'm in a project now, I'm doing some interviews in inner city Atlanta, and most of the people we've interviewed don't know both of their parents and have never lived in a stable home. So, you know, the conservative critique of this is to say, look how bad these people are. How can they do this kind of thing? And we're not going to help them if they're not going to help themselves. If Democrats would simply acknowledge some of those realities and say, you know what, you're absolutely right, that is what it looks like in a lot of inner cities. There are parents who are good parents who are struggling under really tough odds to break out and who do break out. But the odds are stacked against those kids. And as much as you want to blame their parents, look at those kids and ask yourself honestly, what would my kids turn out like if they grew up in that home environment and in that neighborhood? And if you think about it that way, it makes you feel an awful lot more compassion, makes you say, you know what, this isn't about their moral irresponsibility any more than it's about our moral responsibility to see to it that the next generation of kids doesn't have to go through that.
We're a bit past midpoint here. In fact, we're into our last 15 minutes. Let me introduce again our guest, Drew Weston. He is a clinical and political psychologist, professor in the departments of psychology and psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University, and is the author of the book The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation, published by Public Affairs, in which he makes the argument that, indeed, when people make their decisions, when they go into the voting booth, we might like to think that they're making their choice based on a rational assessment of where they are and where the candidates are and how the two best fit together. He says, no, it's not really about, rationality. It is about emotion. And the book is new. It's just out now. If you'd like to take a look at it, you can certainly find it. Questions are welcome, too, here on the show, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I think it is the case, and you can tell me if I'm wrong about this, that for a long time that people believed that individuals formed their political orientation, or maybe, you know, in their late adolescence or their early adulthood, and that it was something that was pretty stable, and that maybe now have come to understand that, well, actually there is potential for it being more fluid than we maybe had thought previously, although I think one of the things we know is that it's really difficult to get people to change. And as your work has pointed out, you know, you're committed to Republicans and committed Democrats. It's not an easy thing to get them to switch. Not impossible, but maybe not easy. Having said all that, do you think that it is possible that you can do that? You know, could we take a committed Democrat and make them a Republican or the other way? And if the answer to the question is, well, yes, we actually could do that, how would you do that?
Well, you probably would start with some kind of surgical procedure to the frontal lobes. The data are pretty clear that partisan minds are closed minds, and they close pretty early. Most of our political sentiments, which are essentially extensions of our moral sentiments, are framed in the context of our families and the values we learn at home. But that being said, there is a lot of research showing that there's a window between age 18 and 30 where people remain open to changing their political ideology and their feelings towards the parties and the party's principles. That is a really important open window, because what it means is, when you think about something like, you know, Howard Dean's 50 state strategy, his idea that Democrats shouldn't just give up on places like Georgia, where I live, or Mississippi, or Alabama, or Missouri, which this time elected a Democratic senator, but that they should compete in all 50 states. He got a lot of flack for it from a lot of people. But from a psychological and a neurological standpoint, he's actually exactly right. Because when you cede a state in 2008 and you say, you know what, we're just not going to campaign there, we're not going to win, you're actually ceding votes in 2080. Because the people who during that time are now learning only one message, and that is the Republican message. And they're learning about Democrats from Republicans because Democrats aren't branding themselves. They're not talking about who they are, and they're not getting any help from the National Party in terms of funding to do that. You are essentially allowing voters' minds to solidify over that period of time who'll be voting 50 years from now. So it really does underscore the importance of having a message out there, having it crystal clear so that people know what you're what you stand for, and having it out everywhere in the United States.
If we go back to your earlier statement about the fact that all voters are values voters, and that people's political orientation, as you say, it has a lot to do with the family into which they're born and its circumstances and its environment, and as much as we'd like to believe that people rebel against their parental values, I'm not sure that that's really all that true. Can you actually say something about why is it someone turns out to be a Republican and someone turns out to be a Democrat, other than the fact that their parents were, or it has something to do with their social class or the milieu that they grew up in, or something like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of research on why people become Democrats or Republicans, and the biggest contributor to it is their parents' values, but that's not the only one. They're also fairly substantial genetic determinants of liberalism versus conservatism. It's been estimated as up to 40%, and it's not that someone is, you know, someone has a gene for preferring donkeys over elephants or vice versa, or that someone has a gene for disliking abortion. It's more that there are attitudes towards change, for example, and feelings about change or feelings about how anxious you become when order is shaken up, that actually do seem to affect people's political attitudes. In fact, there's a great study. It doesn't speak to whether it's genetic or environmental, but there's a great study done by Jack Block at the University of California at Berkeley, published a couple of years ago, that found that you could predict who is going to be conservative or liberal 20 years later from watching them in preschool. And that they were personality characteristics. The kids who were more straight-laced, the kids who were more anxious, tended to be more conservative. The ones who were a little more on the impulsive side and more on the sensation-seeking side and willing to take chances tended to be more liberal 20 years later.
All right. Very interesting. Well, we have several callers here. We have about 10 minutes. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Callers will help us by being brief. Let's go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm certainly enjoying this program. I want to go back to your rationalization of crime vis-a-vis the unpleasant or damaging experiences of usually boys or young men as they grew up. I've heard that articulated many, many, many times, certainly in this university town. That is a very common way of thinking. My concern is two. One, some people don't become criminals. Some people do become positive forces in the community. Therefore, I don't believe that it's a one-for-one, that if I grew up in a particular location, then my actions need to be rationalized by where I came from, because there are probably other people who came from a very similar background, even with aggressive or unhelpful parents, and they do become either average people or outstanding people. The second thing is that my biggest problem with that line of thinking of why these, again, usually young men, behave in this way, what about the victims? Do we say, well, it's too bad that these individuals had this kind of experience, and therefore we understand why they did it? What about the dead, raped, whatever, accosted people who had no reason in any way to be victimized? How does that go into the pot when adding one's values and one's feelings to this kind of a description of a crime?
I think it's a really good and very fair question, and it's one that I think Democrats should do their best to answer honestly. To come back to the first piece of your question, or your comment about some people don't become criminals who grow up in awful areas. That is absolutely true, and the reasons why some do and some don't are things that, as a psychologist, we are just barely starting to understand. We're actually doing a study right now in inner city Atlanta where the average person in our sample has had a third of the people in our sample have had someone close to them murdered in the last year. That tells you what environment they're living in, and that's as adults. And one of the things we're trying to understand is we're actually genotyping our subject that we can understand what genetic endowments that people have and how they interact with their childhood experiences to make some people resilient in the face of what is essentially a war zone. We have rates of in this country and our inner cities of essentially murder and crime that are you don't see anywhere outside of civil wars. Well, this is where I think Democrats would do best to speak honestly about it and not to rationalize about it and to say we do have these huge problems, and the question then becomes how do you address them. But the first question is do you care to address them? And that's where Democrats often don't grab listeners like the caller who just called in, which is what they hear are what voters often hear are the rationalizations. Well, he grew up in a terrible environment. That's how he became that way. Or Democrats get silent, which is what they've done on a lot of these issues because they know that they're connected in a lot of people's minds to race, and they're afraid of talking about race. And my advice on all of these things to Democrats, based on both 25 years of clinical experience as well as the science, both the neuroscience and the psychology, is the last thing you want to do on issues about which people are passionate or about which they're conflicted. They have conflicting feelings. The last thing you want to do is to let those things just fester and not talk about them. The best strategy is to put them out on the table, talk about the inconvenient truths for your own side, the things that you'd rather not admit. Admit them, and then you're able to have a conversation with people that's both much more genuine, much more emotionally compelling, and in a funny way actually allows our capacities for reason to show up on the political stage.
Hmm. We're really short on time. I want to again thank the caller and hope we could try to get at least one more. This is a caller up in the northern part of the state in Oak Brook on line 4. Hello.
Hey, well, good morning. You brought up a lot of good points on how I want to talk about the voting aspect and how the media plays up what, how people should vote. You were talking emotional. And I firmly believe, a lot of my friends think I'm crazy when I say this, but I firmly believe the media has a big role who gets voted in because of the negativity they can portray to the voters. Right now is a good example. Everything is negative. The Democrats are doing their darndest to make the Republicans look bad as far as, everything that comes out there. So people's emotions play on that. And I firmly believe it's not – I think it's 100% emotion and 0% practicality or common sense. Because look at the last two times we voted, either nobody votes or the people that do vote emotionally. How do you feel about that? And am I right on with that?
Well, the whole issue of negative campaigning is one that is really important. Republicans have actually historically never shied away from it. George Bush ran 75% negative ads in the 2004 election against John Kerry, and Kerry tried to run an upbeat, positive campaign. I think that was a very foolish move not just because it empirically does not there's good evidence that people who try to run purely positive campaigns lose. But when you're running against someone who, for example, has allowed Americans to torture people, or when you're running against someone who has created a war that was an unnecessary war, and you follow your advisor's advice not to talk about that stuff, you're essentially jamming voters' emotional radar. In order to be an emotionally informed voter as well as a rationally informed voter, you need the people who are talking with you about who and why you should vote to talk about both the positives and the negatives. And if you think about it from a neurological standpoint, we often think about about feelings, positive and negative feelings, as being opposites of each other. But you know, if I were to ask you, do you love your wife? And I'm talking to the caller. I don't know if you're married, but presuming you are, my guess is that at least on a good day, you'd say yes. And if I ask you, are there times when you get furious at your wife, you almost even hate her, maybe you do hate her, my guess is if you're honest, you'd say probably yes. Well, what does that tell us? It tells us what we've learned from psychology and neuroscience, which is that positive and negative emotions are not the opposite of each other. And if you run just a positive or just a negative campaign, you're essentially ceding half the brain to the other side, and that's just not a good idea.
Well, I guess in thinking about negative campaigning, though, I keep coming back to the fact that when you ask people in surveys, you're always going to get back people saying that they don't like negativity in campaigns and negative advertising. And at the same time, people who are in the business of putting campaigns together say, well, yeah, but negative ads work. You know, why is it that they are both at the same time? We say we don't like them, but they nonetheless they influence us.
It's a great question. It's because if you ask people conscious questions about unconscious processes, you're going to get bad answers. The Republicans knew well when they got that same information from focus groups in 2004. I don't like negativity. You should run a positive campaign. They knew to ignore it because they understand that most of political persuasion is actually not conscious, rational decision making. Versus the Democrats, for example, when John Kerry got swift voted, and when he got the flip flopper charge lodged against him, his advisors looked at the data from surveys and focus groups and said, people don't like negativity, it's going to backfire. And you know, my response to this is always, you don't ask people what's happening in their pancreas. Don't ask them what's happening in parts of their brain that they don't have conscious access to, because they can't tell you. And if they do, they're going to make stuff up that isn't true.
We're just at the point we're going to have to finish in 30, 40 seconds. Tell me of the candidates now who are running for president, both Republican and Democrat, particularly the ones who are considered to be the best positioned. Who do you think are best at communicating on an emotional level?
Well, if you start with the Republican side, I think clearly Mitt Romney is able to do that well. Fred Thompson's able to do that well. Giuliani is able to do that well, at least with some voters. Those are the three who I think do it the best on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, I think the two most natural at it are John Edwards and Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton has been a surprise, I think, in the debates, in that it isn't a natural skill for her to connect with people emotionally, but she's been very forceful, and she's been using humor quite well in the debates, and has come across with a lot of very quick and quick-witted lines that are helpful to her in reducing some of those negatives. So I think on both sides there is a good bit of emotional intelligence among their front runners.
Well, we're going to have to finish. For people who would like to read more on this subject, and there is much more in the book. The book is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nations, published by Public Affairs, by our guest, Drew Weston. He's professor in the departments of psychology and psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University in Atlanta. Professor Weston, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. The show was recorded and first broadcast on July 25th of last year. The show that we had scheduled, a conversation with Matthew Padilla about his book Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. We'll get that rescheduled, and we'll have that conversation on another day. Support for the show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research Institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, the inside story of a landmark Supreme Court case involving executive power and the administration's plans for military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. Our guest will be Jonathan Mahler. He is the author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, and the Fight Over Presidential Power. That will follow the 1 o'clock news. Let's turn our attention now to Kansas City and Chicago and the commodity contracts. In Kansas City, September wheat, that contract trading at 870 and a half, up 43 and a half. December, 892, up 42 and three quarters. In Chicago, September wheat, 850 and a quarter, up 60. December, 875 and a quarter, up 60. September corn, 539, up 30. December, 558 and a half, up 30. March, 577 and three quarters, up 30. And May, 589, up 30. August soybeans, 1276 and a half, up 56 and a half. September, 1277 and a half, up 70. November, 1284, up 70. August meal, 355.70, up $14. August oil, 51.30, up 147. At the Merck in Chicago, August live cattle, 102.97 and a half, up 20.